From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Noe Valley, San Francisco.
DeVos Triangle, Lower Haight.
Visitation Valley.
Downtown San Francisco.
Oh, Ingleside, SF.
Coming up, we learn about the science of fires.
People call California the Golden State. I call it the Pyro State. It really is a fire environment.
Then we'll climb to the top of Mount Tam to look for smoke.
Wow.
Yeah, the nicest room in the San Francisco Bay Area.
And we'll tell you the story behind this week's audiograph mystery sound.
We know from general experience that sometimes 5 minutes seems like 5 hours, and sometimes 5 hours seems like time flies away.
It's getting hot in here today on Cross Currents. This is fire season. All you have to do is look around you to see the effects. 3,100 acres were blackened atop Mount Diablo in September. At the end of last week, at least three grass fires burned simultaneously, shrouding the East Bay in a dense cloud of brown smoke.
The biggest fire was near Suisun City in Solano County. Thousand-acre fire grew so fast, dozens of cows got trapped. Before firefighters finally came to their rescue, let them out of that corral.
And of course, there was the Rim Fire, a massive forest fire that burned 400 square miles across the Stanislaus National Forest and Yosemite National Park at the end of the summer.
Right along Highway 120 right now, and I can feel the heat on my face. These flames are intense.
That fire threatened to contaminate the Hetch Hetchy Reservoir, the primary source of the Bay Area's water supply. It'll be a while until we fully understand the long-term effects of the Rim Fire, especially since most of the people who study that kind of thing are currently furloughed because of the government shutdown. But there are some people actively thinking about it. KALW's Ben Trefney talked with Scott Stevens, a UC Berkeley professor who studies how wildfires work and the complex role human beings play in managing this elemental force. We start with the aftermath of the Rim Fire.
Well, it does look like just tens of thousands and millions of big black sticks. So the sticks are standing straight up, you know, and the soil has got ash on it. You start to look around a little more carefully, though, and you start to see that there actually are some seeds coming out from those burn crowns, which is a little bit of a positive thing. I saw ponderosa pine seeds. I also saw white fir seeds. A lot of times the fires of that type are so intense that even the seeds are killed. Looked like to me, since the fire was late season and some of the trees actually had pretty good abundant cones, that some of those seeds are going to survive. That's actually a positive thing. So there might be a chance for some of that regeneration to occur this spring. Otherwise, it's going to be shrubs for a long time.
And when you talk about the recovery of this kind of an area, will animals be able to come back very quickly? And how long will it take for vegetation to grow basically just in the natural course?
It's amazing how fast animals can come through. When I was out there the other day, I actually saw deer tracks in an area that had been severely burned. The deer were actually already starting to eat some of the oak trees that were resprouting. So the animals can come in and out, I think, pretty thoroughly. But I think the big difference with the animals is the habitat change, so where they live, how much cover is there for them, how much area can they use for nesting and roosting. You know, that area has been changed so much that I don't think we're going to see anything near a forest condition again. 50 years, 100 years, even a little longer in some areas. So the change in habitat has been profound. The shrubs will come back fast. We'll go out there in 5 years from now. A lot of the shrublands, 5, 6, 7 years, they'll look really, really good. A lot of animals using them, birds and actually other things. But the forest itself, the forest is going to take much, much longer to come back. Whether or not they're going to replant part of it is an interesting question, or are we just going to use natural seed? So there are some decisions that have to be made how the trajectory is going to move.
So this was caused by a hunter who had put a fire in a place that was not authorized, and then it spread. But wildfires happen in California frequently. What's good about them in the state's natural course of evolution, but what's perhaps not so good about this one in this case?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, fire, we know, used to be such a big piece of California ecosystems. I did a paper in 2007. We tried to estimate the amount of area burned in California before, say, 1800, before your American settlement. We estimated on the order of 6 million acres a year. Out of that 6 million, maybe 1.2, 1.3 million just in forests. So fire used to be just incredibly common in these ecosystems, just an integral part. But it's been removed now to a point where we almost don't see it at all, except when we get something like a rim fire. So fire coming back actually does have positive consequences, nutrient cycling, regeneration, things of that nature. But when you get these events that cause such mortality patterns, huge amounts of trees dying over thousands and thousands of acres, that really is concerning, because that's the time when we don't see regeneration of these forests coming back really in a long time, 50, 100 years. So even though fire is coming back, we know it's a natural part of the process. Big patches of mortality in those trees, those forests, is really what concerns us.
So what do you think the state should do, if anything, to prevent a rim fire from happening, or to maybe manage its forests differently? Because obviously, there's so much human influence upon the environment at this point in history that they can make choices that can impact what the forest's health will be going forward.
Well, you're right. And at places that used to burn frequently, so mixed conifer forest in the Sierra Nevada, the rim fire, ponderosa pine forest, you know, we know from studies they used to burn every 7, 10, 15 years in the past. That stops around 1910. So the idea would be to go in there and do some manipulation to try to reduce fuel loads and reduce tree density. So things like prescribed burns are certainly possible. Mechanical treatments are too, forest thinning, chipping of material. Those things also can be used to actually try to move the forest back to a condition so when it does burn next time, the fire is just not going to cause the mortality patterns that cause us great grief. You know, you're going to maintain at least half the trees in the overstory. That would be a huge improvement. And we know from research that most of these ecological benefits from fuel treatments are very positive. There's a few things you have to look out for, like maybe bringing in non-native grasses and non-native plants. So there are some potential things that could go a little bit negative. But in my view is if you did that at larger scales and started to move the forest back to a condition where fire, insects, disease could be incorporated, you're really going to end up a much more resilient forest, much more sustainable into the future. You're going to be able to maintain that forest for the future generation. Right now, they're so vulnerable.
Another question that I have is about how the federal furloughs could be affecting forest management or fire recovery. Do you have any awareness of how that could be impacting the rim fire recovery?
Well, I think it's going to slow it down. I was out there the other day, and there were certainly crews from all over the country actually came in there, details to try to work on plans for restoration, plans for assessment. And I think there's even a bigger trend. The number of employees in the Forest Service has actually declined, say, the last 15 years or so. So the fire management staff, the silviculture staff, they've all gone down. And here you are now in a point where you're trying to maybe increase restoration because of a lot of things we've talked about. Frankly, the workforce needs to get bigger, and they also need to have more expertise using fire on these lands. So it's really a conundrum to think about how you're going to move forward when the federal workforce continues to shrink and budgets shrink too. The National Park Service has also been hit. They've been hit with reductions in dollars to do prescribed burning. And they've been hit hard, very hard, even in Yosemite. So when you look at that picture, how are they going to be able to maintain their fire program? So I know we're in a very difficult budget time, but right now budgetary issues are huge. We have to have the workforce and the capacity to do it, plus the resources.
That was Scott Stevens, a UC Berkeley professor who's been studying fire for the past 23 years. He spoke with KALW's Ben Trefney. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. High above the bay at the top of Mount Tam is a little shack up on a stone tower just that much higher above the peak where it sits. It's called the Gardner Lookout, and it's one of two fire lookout towers in Marin County. During the dry season, as many as 50 volunteer fire watchers take shifts in these outposts. They spend days and nights using old brass instruments, maps, a two-way radio, and a box of dog-eared 3x5 note cards to watch over you from a room with windows instead of walls. KALW's Julie Kane visited the Mount Tam lookout to see what the fire watchers see.
Up this high, above the fog line, there aren't houses or corner stores or office towers.
You take your own food, but there's plenty of water up there. It's filtered.
This is Gary Yost. He's a volunteer fire watcher. Besides the parking lot and the lookout, the only other man-made structures he sees are an array of antenna and satellite dishes and a white dome on a peak in the near distance. What are those for?
Oh, that's microwave communications for cell phone companies and TV and radio stations and just corporate data networks, high-speed internet stuff. And then that's the FAA radome, the Federal Aviation Authority's air traffic control radars in there. I think the Air Force uses that too. Still.
Yeah, I can pick up the... I hear it.
Sure.
This sound. Above us, the sky is crisscrossed with an intricate array of long white airplane contrails, fading and drifting into the cloudless bright blue. Below us...
So you can see here we've got the Corte Madera Ridge, and then beyond it is Tiburon and Belvedere, Angel Island, and Richmond Bay, and there's San Quentin and the Richmond Bay Bridge. And it's all just happening, and you can barely hear a rumble of the traffic on 101, but you can hear it. It's the sound of 7 million people.
What's so special about this place is not just what you can hear, it's what you can see. This is one of the best places in the Bay Area to spot fires.
And the lookout was dedicated in May of 1937.
The lookout building is a rugged tower built of stone and wood and ringed by a catwalk. It's protected from intruders by rolls of gleaming razor wire.
And it's solid. I mean, this door weighs 300 pounds. And the rock is 2 to 3 feet thick.
To keep it from burning in a fire.
Okay, so let's go inside. Okay, after you.
In the base of the lookout are shelves of supplies, a refrigerator, a shower stall, and a steep, narrow staircase with a warning sign that says, danger, climbing can cause severe injury.
I don't think it's the climbing that causes the injury, though. It's the falling part. So here we are.
Inside the lookout. Wow.
Yeah, the nicest room in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's pretty sweet.
It's breathtaking.
Oh, my goodness.
On a clear day, you can see as far as 60 or 70 miles in all directions.
What are you looking for?
So you're looking for a column of smoke.
The fire watchers are the first to spot a couple of fires every year. They also monitor fires and keep firefighters updated on how well containment efforts are working.
If you see a smoke, then you use this thing here called the Osborne Fire Finder, which is in every single fire lookout pretty much in the world.
The Osborne Fire Finder is a brass measuring device that looks like it could be a navigational instrument on an old sailing ship. It rotates above a circular map of the Bay Area, kind of like a flattened globe, perched on a tall tabletop at the center of the room. This is what volunteers like Yost use to pinpoint a fire's location.
It'll tell you pretty much where on the vertical the fire is, and you put your eye in this little teeny tiny hole. I mean, this hole is probably a 32nd of an inch across, and you line up one of those two crosshairs on the other side with the smoke, and you rotate the whole unit, which rotates very smoothly, along a 360-degree marked base.
Once the volunteer gets the fire's coordinates, he flips through
this really high-tech 3x5 card file.
The cards are well-worn. Some are typed, some are written in pen. They match up coordinates with landmarks. Some are well-known and easy to identify. Others, not so much.
Here's the Chicken Shack Fire Road, which runs along that ridge from Big Rock Ridge easterly towards Pacheco Valley. The Chicken Shack Fire Road.
Your Boston 11 commercial fire alarm.
When they know where the fire is, the volunteers call it in on a two-way radio. It's always on, chattering in the background.
He's a 40-year-old male, holding conscious back there.
During the day, the volunteers have lots of company. The summit of Mount Tam is a popular spot. People come for that spectacular view. After dark and early in the morning, though, the volunteers have the mountaintop all to themselves.
The sunrise up here starts real early in the summer. You know, 4 o'clock, you can start to see light come into the sky, and there's all sorts of amazing visual effects that the rising sun has on the fog. So if you're really lucky, the fog will be fully in at sunrise, and you'll get that feeling of complete isolation. And if the fog has come in the night before you've gone to sleep, or maybe you've woken up in the middle of the night, or maybe you haven't gone to sleep at all, what you see underneath the fog are these shifting lights underneath the fog. So San Francisco and Marin County and the East Bay become kind of an underwater light show. And then if the fog is really, really deep, you don't see any of the lights of the Bay Area, but then the stars are as bright as the stars in the middle of the desert.
A desert of 7 million people and one volunteer perched on the mountaintop watching over us, looking for smoke. At the top of Mount Tam, I'm Julie Kane for Cross Currents.
If you want to see a video from the Gardner Lookout, head to our website. It's kalw.org.
We are currently experiencing longer than normal wait times.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. All week long on KALW, we've been playing you this sound.
Please continue to hold, and your call will be answered by the next available agent.
We asked you to tell us what that was and where we recorded it. But before we tell you the answer, here's a little background. Last week, the state opened its new health insurance marketplace called Covered California. It's a way for people who are uninsured to purchase health insurance plans that meet the requirements of the Affordable Care Act. On opening day, Covered California was busy. The website saw almost 1 million hits and close to 60,000 people tied up on their phone lines. Waits of over 30 minutes were common.
Your call is important to us and will be answered in the order it was received.
Which brings us back to our audiograph mystery sound. Why do we stay on hold? To bring us the answer, KLW's Daniel Moore talked to V.J. Kirshnan, a marketing professor who studies the science of hold music.
Is there a best kind of hold music?
It is difficult to say unequivocally what type of music is the best, but we can provide some insights.
All lines are still busy. Please hold.
The traditional view is that if you play simple music, you know, the elevator music kind of thing, 4-4 beat cycles, easily memorable repetitive musical pattern, for instance, might be good because it does not arouse the listener and it does not require the listener to pay too much attention to the music that is being listened to. However, recent research turns this logic on its head. We find, for instance, that playing somewhat complex music might be better. We come to this conclusion because usually the listener is upset based on the listener's perception of how much time has elapsed while waiting on the call. We call this the retrospective estimation of time.
Please stay on the line and your call will be answered in the order it was received.
The best kind of hold music is the kind that makes the listener think So if the music can draw the attention, user's attention, such that his cognitive resources are used in processing the music itself, so if the music is interesting, somewhat surprising, somewhat different, in short, a little bit complex, that engages the thinking process of the listener, then the listener does not have time to think about other things to fill up the time.
We're sorry, all attendants are still busy.
I want to play you some music, the hold music for the Covered California website, which is the new healthcare exchange in California that was set up as part of the Affordable Care Act. And I'd love to hear whether or not you think it's good hold music. Are you ready?
Okay, go on.
Okay.
Yeah, it's kind of very repetitive. And I'm not able to clearly identify the genre there. But
me neither.
Yeah, but it's very repetitive, so that after the first time the pattern repeated, I switched off thinking about the music, and I'm just sort of tapping on the table waiting for the music to end.
Well, only one of you recognized this song. Congratulations, Glenn. It's your second audiograph win. We'll be sending you a KLW t-shirt again. Before we go, we want to play you a voicemail we got from a listener about being on hold.
Hi, KLW. I'm calling anonymously about my experience with Covered California. I called the 800 number the first day that it was operational, October 1st. I did wait 30 minutes, and then a very helpful, intelligent, well-educated navigator walked me through the entire application process. I will be waiting for approval of my application, perhaps for a 30-day period. Please don't discourage people about applying or calling because of a 30-minute wait or a 30-day waiting period. There are things in life that are worth waiting for. This is certainly one of them. Thank you for getting the word out.
One thing you won't have to wait for is next week's mystery sound. Here's your sneak peek.
I will make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry lands, I should walk faster, the dry lands springs of water.
Stay tuned to KLW to hear it again, or check out Audiograph on our website, klw.org. Thus concludes today's Cross Currents from KLW News. The team includes Julie Kane.
Wow.
Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Laura Flynn, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Christina Loring, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Ryan Miller, Stephen Short, and Todd Whitney. The show is engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our senior producer. Our executive editor is Ben Trefney. Holly Kernan is our news director. Tune into Cross Currents Monday at 5 when we hear what's on the mind of a San Quentin inmate about to get released on parole.
Being able to trust people, that is something I had been struggling with for quite some time, and I took that from my childhood out there in here, and to be honest with you, I'm still struggling with that right now today.
The latest from San Quentin Prison Radio. That's Monday at 5 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
It's not a canary, and I have got a vision, but I'm not a visionary.
This band is called La Di Da from San Francisco. They're playing a week from tonight, October 17th, at the Subterranean Art House in Berkeley. Music starts at 7:30. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.